Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Our profits will continue to grow. We will have more for you. Our economy will continue to grow. More jobs, more jobs. Every politician promises you one big thing, growth, even if it kills the ecosphere. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Are you ready to get smaller? We drill for energy in more dangerous places. We boil tarry oil out of the sand. Some metals get rare. We got to get the oil reserves out of the ground while ecosystems falter. The resource game can't keep up as another billion people want cars, computers, big homes, meat diets. New consumers just like us, all depending on fossil fuels, are all over the world. A growing voice of scientists and economists say it just can't last. They are the heretics who say the economy must shrink. It is called degrowth. A smaller GDP could be a good thing. Should we wait for the oil to run out, food to run out, for collapse? Or can we plan our way back down through power down, simplification, and localization? You are about to hear two speakers from the opening panel at the latest degrowth conference on June 3, 2011, in Vancouver, Canada. From the fore, Dr. Bill Reese, the inventor of the ecological footprint concept, and Conrad Schmidt, author and filmmaker, founder of the Work Less Party. Both of these men are annoying. Professor Bill Reese listens and looks at all the schemes offered as solutions. Then he measures the actual results. Sometimes that isn't so pleasing, especially when we had such good intentions. Conrad Schmidt can look a paradox in the eye. Does a hybrid car really save any energy? Is cheaper alternative energy really good for the planet? Rude questions indeed. Here we go from a compilation of recordings from that Degrowth Vancouver panel, starting with Conrad Schmidt.
Yeah, it's been quite a bit of a hectic day because I've been helping organize this conference, and it's really exciting to see this event finally happen. And so I know a lot of people have heard me with this story before, but I love telling it anyway. And I like to talk a little bit about something called the Jevons Paradox. It's probably the single most important concept in understanding the requirements of ecological sustainability. Really confusing. Simple to solve, but confusing. Here's a quick question. Which one of these is better for the environment? A bicycle, sounds a little crazy, or an SUV? Well, the answer is it depends. Here's the story. There was this time I used to have this job, and I used to head off to work, and I used to drive in my SUV off to work. And I was feeling guilty. And I said, you know what, I want to reduce my ecological footprint. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of that SUV. I'm going to ride a bike. And I did. I got rid of that SUV, and I started taking public transportation, riding my bike. And it was great. I was getting healthy. Life was good. But here's where the Jevons paradox comes into play. It was at the end of the month. I got this big, happy surprise. My paycheck. There was 25% more money. I was saving money. Oh, this is great. I'm going to buy a camera. No, I'm going to go to France. I'm going to fly in an airplane. Maybe a vacation. Bigger home. You see, there's the conundrum. Once that money re-enters in the economy, that efficiency benefit simply results in increased growth. Let me give you a few more examples. Often we think of, well, that we can become more efficient and reduce our ecological footprint. But if you look back, coal was 50% more energy efficient than wood and produced, and you didn't have to chop down forests. Petroleum was 50% more efficient than coal and less sulfur and mercury. Each green technology, each of those could be, on our definition of green, could have been regarded as a green technology over its predecessor. That's the Jevons paradox, you see. Any efficiency that inserted into the economy puts a mandate that either we increase and consume more or we face rising unemployment. The solution is simple, really simple, even though it might sound confusing. So the way I personally solved it, I said, what was I going to do with that extra money? Well, I walked into my boss's office and I said, how about I don't show up here on a Friday and you don't pay me? He thought about it for 10 seconds and said, yeah. I reduced my work week. I worked less. I produced less and I consumed less. And I now had more time. And I started getting involved in community. I wrote a book. Well, actually, I have to confess, I wrote most of the book while I was actually working. But I made films. My quality of life dramatically increased. That's the simple solution, is you can reduce your work week, or you have to find some other way of counterbalancing the efficiencies that have been inserted into the economy. There are lots of ways that it can be done. More healthcare providers, more teachers, organic agriculture, because you have more people producing, your labor input increases, but your output stays the same. Any situation where your input, your labor input, increases for a fixed amount of output, all has that same type of benefit of counterbalancing efficiencies. Personally, my favorite is working less. Thank you.
The next speaker is Dr. Bill Rees, professor at the University of British Columbia and co-inventor of the ecological footprint concept.
Thank you very much. I'm a very practical person, and I subscribe to my previous colleague's notion of paying attention to the numbers. Show me the numbers. And I want to get to that in a moment, but I first want to underscore that despite the question that's been posed to this panel, sustainability is not fundamentally a technological question. It's really a question about human behavioral responses to the situation that we're in. The simple reality is, if you want to pick up an interesting book, it's called Factor 5 by Ernst von Weizsäcker. It shows that using off-the-shelf technologies, we could, in theory, produce exactly what we're producing on the planet today with about one-fifth the current energy and material throughput. So in theory, there's little question, it seems to me, that we could, and the question was posed, can new green technologies or business practices enable us to continue to grow while reducing our footprint? In theory, that's a real possibility. In practice, my prediction is that it will not happen. And it will not happen for reasons of human behavior, including an endemic problem that we have of being in a state of deep denial when it comes to serious challenges to our current way of life. We also have to keep a number of other things in mind, that the ecological crisis, the sustainability crisis, is in fact a product of technology. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, which was essentially a technological revolution, there was no ecological crisis. It's modern technology operating very often through the Jevons effect or the rebound effect that has enabled the human enterprise to expand to nearly 7 billion people with ever-increasing per capita demands on the planet. And it's that reality that has caused us to breach global ecological limits and has precipitated the ecological or sustainability crisis. Without technology, and particularly fossil fuel technologies, none of that would have been possible. I think it's also important to point out that this isn't just about reducing the carbon footprint. Every dimension of consumption is increasing. And as the human footprint increases, in fact, it's not decreasing anywhere, as the human footprint increases, it simply displaces other species and increasingly poorer people right off the planet. Let me make just a couple of very quick points. What we do is measure things. And the simple reality is that in every major country, especially the most efficient countries, per capita consumption or throughput overall of energy and material continues to increase. That is a product of technology. If you read anything about carbon dioxide emissions, you will have seen in the last couple of days that after a very minor downtick in the rate of increase last year, CO2 emissions are now increasing at a higher than ever rate once again this year, to the point where globally CO2 emissions are rising at about 2 parts per million per annum. The world is not reducing its ecological or its carbon footprint, which is only a fraction of the total ecological footprint. So we have to recognize that what science tells us is that we need an 80% reduction in material and energy throughput on a per capita basis in rich countries to vacate the ecological space needed for justifiable growth in poor countries. We need, did you hear me? An 80% reduction in material and energy throughput on a per capita basis. That amounts to about a 50% reduction globally, but obviously a greater share of that falls on the already rich countries. So again, the requirement is a 50% global reduction, and all we're getting is a 3 or 4% annual increase in material throughput, including a global increase in our carbon emissions. It's simply not the case that these are going down on a global basis. The human ecological footprint continues to increase. Now, just a final point. In countries, we often hear that the more efficient countries and countries that are shifting to a high-income service economy reduce their footprints. For example, Switzerland is often cited as having a very low energy to GDP ratio. But that's a fallacy, or rather an artifact, of trade data and the way economists count things. If you actually look at material flows into Switzerland through trade, the global or the footprint of the Swiss is as large as any other major European country, and they're not reducing their carbon footprint as indicated by actual consumption of goods and services. When we export our manufacturing industries to third world countries, the normal way of accounting for carbon is that the carbon produced in the production of goods and services for consumption in Canada are attributed to Chinese, for example. That becomes part of their apparent global footprint, but it's really ours. It's associated with our consumption. So when we correct our trade flows in this manner, it turns out that in most places that are in high-income service kinds of economies, the fallacy is revealed. They are not, in fact, reducing their eco-footprints. These eco-footprints continue to rise as a function of income when all flows of energy and material are taken into account. So we really haven't gotten serious about the sustainability challenge. A 50% reduction globally translated into an 80% reduction in the rich countries is not the same as the continuous global increase at the rate, just in terms of carbon dioxide alone, of 2 parts per million annually in our carbon dioxide emissions. Thank you.
We're listening to a conference on degrowth, the planned shrinking of the economy, and our demands on the natural world, recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Well, I guess we've come to some agreement that we've got a problem. So it seems to me the really important question is, what would an intelligent species do?
We're definitely not it.
in our present situation, because we're not acting intelligently. If we can honestly say that the technology exists, the means exists to reduce our eco-footprints while spreading, you know, the benefits of material growth to those who really deserve it, and we don't do that, then there's something clearly wrong with the way we function in the world. Part of it has to do with the way we apply the technology that we have. Most technological fixes today are oriented toward maintaining the status quo, to continuing the growth trajectory and the increases in income that we all, quote-unquote, enjoy annually. Now, the really important question is that a necessary thing to do? And I think we have to look very carefully at the consequences of material growth, both at the micro level, the individual level, and at the macro level. And when we do that, we find that in almost no advanced country is there any longer a correlation between personal or felt well-being and rising per capita income. So here we are, and again, I want you to keep asking yourself, are these the acts of an intelligent species? Maintaining our foot on the economic throttle by technological and other means to increase per capita consumption of goods and services, while it provides no personal individual benefit that's measurable, is a questionable activity, is it not? Moreover, if we look at most of the objective indicators of population well-being, they all show the same relationship. From your point of view, longevity rises with income, and then it flattens out and is level after that. It's called a diminishing returns curve. The curve begins to diminish at about $12,000 international per year, or about a quarter of Canadians' current per capita income, thereabouts, I forget the exact numbers. So the point is that in many rich countries, we've gone three or four or five times beyond the point where, in terms of the objective indicators, there's no further performance. Infant mortality is static. Longevity is static. It's actually falling in the United States, and so on. So again, on objective indicators, why are we so dedicated to maintaining the growth path if there's no further performance in terms of the quality of life measured in those means? So an intelligent species would ask a different question, and that is, what is the optimal scale of the economy that produces an adequate per capita income to max out in all of those factors that we consider to be important? After that, growth is futile. In fact, it's worse than futile, because if you count up all the damage costs of growth, and let's assume that my colleague is correct in that climate change is clearly underway today. Think of the damage costs of just what you've read about in the last months. They amount to billions and billions of dollars. We may well be at the point where the costs of growth, even in measurable dollar terms, exceed the benefits of growth in measurable dollar terms. So we are in a phase of what Herman Daly, another ecological economist, has called a phase of uneconomic growth. We're used to talking about economic growth, which is a good thing, but by definition, if growth is destroying more value than it's producing, then it's uneconomic and foolish to proceed. So again, the question becomes, what would an intelligent species do? Now, part of the problem is that some of our species, a little more intelligent than others, they've created a huge industry of counterintelligence, convincing people to vote against their own interests, for example, as we've seen in recent federal election in Canada and in the congressional elections in the United States recently. This is an unprecedented phenomenon where the capitalist class are spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year to spin scientific information to produce exactly the opposite face on reality that science proclaims. So we have a segment of society dedicated to socially constructing a scientifically false and, in fact, inverted picture of reality, and it's out of that picture that most ordinary people act, even though it's against their own interest. Now, there's another dimension of this we really have to keep in mind, and what I'm trying to underscore here is why this is not a technical problem, but a behavioral problem and a cultural problem. The distribution of the alleged costs and benefits is skewed. Those people in a position of power to actually do anything about the economy, to actually do anything about the application of the technologies that could pull us off, to put in place the tax incentives required to bring in play the innovative alternative energies and so on, they have no incentive to do so. They represent vested interests in the existing coal industry, oil industry, and so on and so forth. And so the benefits go to them. They have no interest to act. The costs fall on the poor, who aren't in a position to act, either politically or in terms of implementing policies. So we have a tremendous problem here in that the benefits and costs of the current paradigm fall disproportionately on the rich and poor, resulting in a form of social paralysis, which can only be overcome if there's essentially a popular revolution, which is being headed off by this propagandistic campaign to convince everybody of an untruth. I've gone on far longer than I should, but I've got 14 more pages I'd like to cover here. Thank you.
Why do we want to have economic growth at either the micro or the macro level?
Here is Conrad Schmidt.
In many ways, it's not optional. There's something I said a little earlier back. Technology, for the most part, makes us more efficient. Efficiency puts a mandate on the economy. Either grow, consume more, or face rising unemployment. Anytime you make something more efficient, any part of industry, it has to be counterbalanced by either rising unemployment or increased growth. A good example is the Great Depression. There were a lot of fantastic new inventions. Henry Ford comes up with the assembly line, the electrification of industry. They now can produce 20% more cars with the same amount of labor, 30%, 40%, 50%, and by 1916 it had doubled. You could produce more with less labor. That's what technology does. It makes us more efficient. Now, the consequence was that people were not consuming more. Our great-grandparents, they were kind of the frugal bunch. Well, I'm going to save this chest of drawers. I don't need to. I'll pass it on from one generation to the next. Even though they had invented mass production, they hadn't invented mass consumption. And that's why there was a Great Depression. Any situation, even today, today we have the internet. It's making everybody so much more efficient. You now can have a store. You don't actually need employees. You just ship it by mail. Any efficiency puts that same mandate on the economy. And that's part of the problem, is that it is the impetus to growth. A lot of the things that we think are the solutions, be more efficient, just simply put that same mandate back into the economy. Thanks.
I'd like to take a run at that question. Growth is needed, but in the developing world. We have a situation today in which the richest 20% of the human family consume 76.5% of everything, and the poorest 20% live on 1.5% of total income. This incredible income disparity is immoral, unethical, and is unsustainable in and of itself. Therefore, it seems quite obvious that if there is to be growth in the world economy, it should occur in third world countries, which are still on that part of the curve where there's net benefits obtained from higher levels of consumption. But in order to create the ecological space on the planet for that growth to occur, rich countries must reduce their per capita consumption. Now, that sounds like a horrible thing, but ask Conrad. When you give up a day of work, your income may go down, but you've gained a whole day of spare time or free time to spend on, what's that word, self-actualization, with your family, engaged in political activities, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why they want you to work all the time, so you don't actually get serious about the politics of our country. What we really need in order to make this happen is a whole new array of social safety nets so that people can downsize, move between jobs from the old to the new economy without fear of income loss. That means changing the tax system so that people who have excess income are sharing some of it with those who have insufficient income. You know, this whole issue of sustainability is a collective problem. You can't solve it alone. No country can solve it alone. Collective problems require collective solutions, policies put in place on the behalf of the whole of society by their governments. You cannot implement a rapid transit system. You cannot implement a carbon tax. But together, we can implement a carbon tax if our governments respond to a sufficient pressure to do so. And it will begin to have the restructuring effects on the economy that will lead toward the implementation of some of the technologies that will actually help us to move forward. So there's a whole array of things that could happen, but we're not doing them because of misinformation, because of denial, and our basic intransigence as human beings in our reluctance to change from what we take to be a fairly comfortable position in life.
Well, the idea behind degrowth is really quite simple. And that is, we don't need to redefine growth. We just need to stop doing what we're doing. Growth is not sustainable. There's lots of ways you can look at it. It is a bit of a divided movement in some aspects, but it's about bringing people together who want to challenge the idea of corporations busy funding all the research, who want to challenge a lot of the ideas about mainstream economics and start thinking about ways that we can be more socially sustainable.
Professor Bill Reese.
Well, I think there's two things that degrowth really brings into this picture. The first is to get people to stop, as one of us said, you know, thinking of these things as religions. It's not a question of whether you believe in growth or not, or you believe in sustainability or not. We have actual numbers to show the state of the world. We know that 75% of the world's fisheries are in trouble, and many stocks have collapsed. We know that climate change is a reality. We know that carbon dioxide emissions are 40% higher now than they were 150 years ago. Not emissions, but concentrations in the atmosphere. From ecological footprint analysis, we know that the current rate of consumption of biocapacity, the stuff the Earth's ecosystems produce every year, is about 50% higher than the annual rate of production. That means each year we use more than 50% more than the Earth is producing. Now you can ask, well, how can that be? And it's because we're drawing down the stocks of soil, fisheries, forests, biomass, and so on and so forth. We can continue to live by depleting assets for a certain period of time, but then you reach the point where you simply don't have enough biocapacity or ecosystems function left to sustain even current levels of consumption. So we're way beyond the point where we should be talking about whether growth is good, bad, or indifferent. It is valid, however, to talk about different kinds of growth. And what I'm talking about and the things we measure is material and energy throughput. It's the physical growth. You can have, in theory, income growth without an increase in material and energy throughput. This could happen if we applied some of the high-gain efficiency technologies which currently rest on the shelf because, for example, we're not willing to put in the tax incentive necessary for prices to tell the truth so that those technologies can compete with oil, gas, and some of the primitive technologies that are taking us down the tubes. So again, this is a very difficult set of questions, but if we think it through as intelligent human beings, we can see some light at the end of the tunnel. But as a culture, as a society, we are failing to do that. And as a result, most of the trends that have led us to this point of recognizing that we are unsustainable continue unabated. Now, again, I'll concede that in some isolated places you see real progress being made, but it's a marginal 1 or 2 or 3% of the total economic activity. It's wiped out with 1 year of growth.
That was my recording from the opening panel at the Degrowth Conference held at Simon Fraser University in downtown Vancouver on June 3, 2011. As we wrap up, just a word about our companion program, Earthbeat. That green hour of radio has been going out in the U.S. and Canada for over 6 years with early host Mike Tidwell and later Daphne Wysham. It's a super show with some of the best guests and breaking stories. Right now, Earthbeat is on hiatus while the production team reorganizes and refinances. Keep up to date with Earthbeat by going to the site at earthbeatradio.org. Find out all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thanks for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.